Welcome to episode 128 of Breakout Culture. I'm Ed Vasey, the culture editor of Country and Townhouse magazine.
And I'm the associate editor at the magazine. Now, listeners will already know that Country and Townhouse achieved its B Corp status earlier this year. And so Ed and I are delighted that this podcast is now being supported by Lomi, the smart waste appliance that turns food waste into plant food. So it's good for the planet as well as being extremely useful.
Yes, we love Lomi. It's a small, sleek machine that sits on your countertop and gets rid of all that food waste. None of us like food waste smelling up the rubbish bin and leaking gunge when you get round to taking the bin bags out. We also love Lomi, of course, because its sponsorship is enabling us to carry on inviting wonderful guests onto this podcast, like today's guests, two highly renowned artists, Emily Young and Frances Hamill.
Yes, now Emily Young has been hailed as Britain's greatest living stone sculptor. She specialises in using materials from abandoned quarries and transforming them into monumental heads and forms. She has an exhibition of new work coming up at Richard Green on Bond Street in association with Willoughby Gerrish Limited. Frances Hamill is known for his portraiture and landscape paintings. You might have seen his work, which graces the staircase walls of Fortnum & Mason on London's Piccadilly. And over the years, he's had numerous exhibitions, including one at the V&A in 2019 of leading figures in film and theatre. He too has a new touring exhibition coming up, which launches at his Oxfordshire home, Rousham. Welcome, Emily and Frances.
Hi. Lovely to be here.
Great to have you both with us. And can we start with you, Emily? Because of the rave press reviews you've had, they're astonishing. The Telegraph has said you've inherited the mantle of Dame Barbara Hepworth as Britain's greatest female stone sculptor. The FT showers you with praise as well. So start by describing your work to our listeners before we start to talk about your new exhibition.
I don't use traditional blocks of stone, which... Previously, art sculptors in stone would buy a block that was going to serve their idea of what it was they were going to be making. They had it clear. What I discovered was that when I was wandering around stone yards looking at things, there would be these offcuts or bits that had the wrong shape to be useful in some more traditional ways. And I liked seeing the geology. I liked seeing these mad crystals coming out and these break lines and these strange colours. Sometimes you wouldn't know what was inside the stone, but it had obviously been sitting there for, you know, maybe generations. Some of these stone yards are very, very old. And they have their cemeteries where old stones that aren't useful in the modern world, but they're sitting there and they're black, basically. And you chip away a little corner and what do you know? It's sort of green and yellow stripes of something inside. And so I started being far more interested in these pieces that were, they were sort of, some people call them fragments, but in fact, they're, you know, they can be vast. They can be, you know, a couple of tons or, I mean, some of the pieces I work are 3-4 tons. But the reason that I'm so sort of enamored of my the world I live in now is that you get a real sense of the history of the earth. So, I mean, my lifespan is tiny compared to the planet. The older I get, the more I realize how important it is to see oneself as simply a part of a great entity. It's sort of magical, but you can enter into this way of thinking about yourself on Earth as you are simply a very small part of a very long time frame. My pieces are going to endure along with the planet. Some of them are very, very hard indeed, the quartzites. I am saying what we are now is not all we could be. And in the future, if we have, you know, blown up the earth in a firestorm of greed and industrialization, if that has happened, then the stones will still stay there and there'll be like an archaeological remnant of, oh, look, looks like a Buddha. Because they're all the faces, the heads are all peaceful.
I mean, I've seen the catalogue for your new exhibition, and it is absolutely beautiful. Just tell us a bit about your upcoming exhibition at Richard Green, because it's a real departure for Richard Green to take on a sculptor. And they're terribly excited because they're saying that they now put you in the canon with, you know, Moore and Frink and Hepworth. So tell us about the 25 works that are going to be at Richard Green from the 25th of October.
I would just say the lovely thing about Moore and Frink and Hepworth is that Moore was born in 1898. They are all dead. And that is, they've actually been dead for decades. And I'm not dead. They all had designs that they were working towards, and I don't have that. I don't know. Each piece of stone is going to tell me what it wants to be. And we work together, and it's not finished until it's finished. It lets me know how far I can go in one direction. It's a real debate. I call it marriage. So the pieces there, they're pieces that come from very locally from here. They're literally, they're...
When you say here, Italy, because you're...
Yes, I live in, on the coast of southern Tuscany. So basically, all of the pieces in this new show are things like that. Stones that I've found in abandoned quarries or to old stone yards. There's a couple of pieces that are that are completely worked, and those are the torsos. And they have this stillness as well. They're basically female torsos. And there's a kind of life force that goes through stone as well. And the stone's very beautiful. Some of them are translucent, the light comes through. And the forms are very, very simple, but definitely not weirded out. You know, they're not expressionist in any way. They are classical. Because I really like the early art that we did. I don't feel very much association with the arts of the last few centuries. I love some of them, obviously, but Michelangelo was a bit of a cut-off. But go back as far as you can into the history of humans making things with stone. That actually goes back to our ancestors. They're not Homo sapiens. They're going back to 3.5 million years ago. And they have lasted all that time. Nothing else can we really tell about these people. I'm quite sort of serious about, I want to make a comment that has something of that is the best of us now, that we are capable of incredible compassion, incredible quietness and stillness in relation to the way that we use the earth. When I carve the stone, it's like I'm making a comment, a strong comment, saying, I give a shit, you know, and I'm going to talk to the future using the things from the past. It's my little gift to the future.
So your sculptures are not huge. I mean, when I rock up to Richard Green and buy your oeuvre, I can put a lot of it in the back of the car.
Well, some of them are, I've got some that I've done, have been sort of 4 or 5 tons. So no, they're not small.
Are the ones at Richard Green big ones or all sorts of different sizes?
They're the ones that will go in a gallery in New Bond Street. So they're not very big.
So in fact, what you were just saying, Emily, about stillness and the earth's beauty and everything, that brings us very nicely onto you, Francis, because your beautiful, beautiful paintings are of some of England's most wonderful gardens. So tell our listeners a bit about you and Rousham, where you've lived for years and years, and about how that's inspired you.
It sounds a bit grand that when you say Rousham is my home, and it is my home, but I'm a tenant there. So it's someone else owns it. And I, for 25 or 26 years, have rented a cottage and a studio on the estate. And I'm sort of fully embedded there and don't really have any plans to leave at any time. But for you mentioned I did a big collection of portraits a few years ago. After that, I went and painted in China because I was curious to have a look at the landscapes, some of the landscapes in China. And just as I was about to exhibit the collection of paintings of China, the pandemic happened. So we were sort of locked into Rousham. And for the first time, although I've painted the trees and lots of things around the gardens there, I'd never really dared paint the gardens because I felt that they were a sort of complete statement. They were designed by William Kent, part of them, in the 1740s by Bridgman just before that, and then there are Jacobean gardens. So there's a very, very beautiful, quite famous sort of culty garden there, which felt complete, and I didn't feel I could either add anything to it or feel really comfortable about making an examination until Boris told us we couldn't leave home. And then I thought maybe this is the time to really look closely at the gardens and try and capture some of their magic. And in a way, painting well is about trying to look at things as though you've never seen them before. And the pandemic oddly managed to give me a kind of glimpse of Rousham as though it was something I hadn't lived in for 25 years. And the pandemic had that sort of effect, I think, on a lot of people, but certainly Rousham for a moment looked unfamiliar. And so I kind of did a big collection of paintings of that, which I showed at Rousham and then in London at the John Martin Gallery 2 years ago. And then it was really difficult to stop. I thought I'd done enough. And then I just found myself carrying on painting Rousham and then thought, well, now we're allowed out, why not go and look at some other gardens? I started with the winter gardens, the gardens that still look good when, you know, the gardens with good bone structure like Levens Hall and Bodnant and Iford Manor, places with lots of topiary and lots of sculpture and lots of structure to them that don't rely on displays of flowers and gorgeousness of the summer and all that growth. And then as the seasons moved on, I sort of, and the landscape woke up, I moved on to various other places. I was quite keen not to just paint grand gardens. There are quite a lot of grand gardens, and there are quite a few that are open to the public. Great Dixter, Sissinghurst, the Stourhead, some wonderful gardens in Scotland, Little Sparta. I mean, it was a fantastic adventure. And I suppose the excitement for me is I'm a landscape painter a lot of the time. And looking at the landscape through the prism of gardens is exciting to me because they're landscapes with attitudes. They're little bits of landscape that have been domesticated and transformed. And I don't want to make picture postcards of the gardens. And a lot of the pictures probably wouldn't even be recognisable to people that know the gardens as those places. But there, I use the garden really as a way of just looking at the landscape. I tend to start very early in the morning and work late into the evening so that the theatre of low light is part of the pictures.
Well, from what I've seen of your catalogue, they do look absolutely beautiful. But just tell our listeners who might not know so much about Rousham a little bit about it.
It's a private garden belonging to a family that have owned it for ages. But it's been open to the public. It's open every day of the year, and it's very uncommercial. Children aren't really allowed in. There's no tea room. There's nothing you buy. There's a ticket machine where you get a ticket. And you feel almost a sense of trespass as you go in because no one's trying to sell you anything. You park your car and steal into this garden. And you feel it's yours while you're there. And it's never very crowded. But it is completely full of magic, really.
And it's designed by William Kent, and it's described as one of England's most important gardens.
There's a little gate lodge. You drive down an avenue of lime trees, and you feel that sense of excitement that you do when the curtain lifts in the theatre. As though you're kind of entering a world where belief is suspended. It has a sort of real magic. And the cultural almonds, you know, their only policy really is not to intervene, not to do anything, to keep it as it is as much as you can. Of course, gardens are constantly on the move, so it's quite a tall order to keep a garden standing still. And actually, in a way, by painting pictures of them, you're sort of, I mean, going back to what Emily was talking about, with these sculptures that last indefinitely and are part of geological time rather than human time. Pictures don't last for anything like as long, but a garden doesn't stay the same from one year to the next. So in an odd and sort of incidental way, the pictures, I suppose, are memorialising gardens. Although, as I say, I'm not trying to paint, you know, testimonials or maps. I'm trying to record just what the garden feels like to me at the time I'm there.
It looks amazing, I have to say, Rousham. And it's been in the same family since 1635. But you are a very versatile painter as well, Francis, because you do a lot of portraits. In fact, your portraiture seems to focus on the stage.
Well, I've been lucky to have Cameron McIntosh as a collector, and he's become a friend. But for a long time, he's been collecting pictures, and I did a big project with him painting the Professors of Contemporary Theatre, which is an appointment, a sort of annual professorship at St Catherine's College, Oxford. And it's still going on, but each year they appoint a Professor of Contemporary Theatre. Started with Stephen Sondheim, Alan Ayckbourn, Ian McKellen, Diana Rigg. I mean, it was a very interesting collection of really powerful presences, playwrights, actors, and directors in the world of theatre. So I had to paint 27 portraits. I actually stopped painting portraits after because it was sort of enough a couple of years ago. So it was quite nice to get back into the landscape, which is infinitely more cooperative than a lot of the people I was trying to paint.
I was going to ask Emily how she got started.
Well, my grandmother was a sculptor, so I knew that a woman could be a sculptor. In fact, I started off as a painter, but I never really stopped drawing. And then one day I came across a slab of marble, and incidentally somebody had left a bag of stone carving tools, an artist friend of mine, and he said, I'm not using these, can I just leave these here for a bit in my house? I had this slab of marble in the garden for some reason, and I thought, oh, I'm going to put these two things together. So I started drawing. It was little reliefs, sort of basso rilievo, they call it, which is where you're going. It's a very, very shallow carving into a piece of stone. And I loved it. And I loved the resistance of the stone. And it was like I'd come home. I'd sort of met my mate in some way. I just loved it. And gradually, well, quite quickly, I started working at more more 3D, and the pieces got bigger and bigger. And I started going to stone yards and making friends with the people who were selling the stone, and people would find me things that they said, oh, you'll like this, Emily. It's just this huge, nobody wants this. It's been here for hundreds of years. You'll like this. I say, yes, I will. And then, so, and that was, what, 30 years ago.
And do you still draw now? Is drawing a part of the process of making a sculpture for you?
Well, it is, but it's more internal. I mean, I'm constantly drawing. Like, if I put the line there, what will happen? So,
you're drawing with a chisel.
I'm drawing, yes. And I do use a sort of a black stick, a sort of carbon stick, just to point out to myself, don't forget to address that bit, even though you're sort of theoretically finished or something. But I don't like that. I'll come back to that. So that's a constant turning around in three dimensions, obviously.
If you're being given or choosing from a quarry, a piece of stone or marble or crystallite or whatever, if you're working on it, presumably often the pieces have been rejected because of the risk that they're going to kind of shatter into a thousand pieces if you chisel them or carve into them. So is there a risk of sort of self-destruction in the middle of the process?
I mean, there's this lovely thing that happens with a piece of stone, and it can be a stone that's, you know, the size of your thumbnail, or it can be, you know, a 20-ton block. If you give it a little tap, it will give a very different sound, bell-like. It will give a bell-like sound, as opposed to, there's a kind of a duh. It's like, it sounds dead. And that's, and in the stone business, you say that it's not sound. That is not a sound piece of stone. You won't use it. You'll abandon it. Now, sometimes.
So you only ever work on pieces of stone that make that nice dead sound when you tap them?
No, I won't use that.
Okay.
The bell sound you wait for, the bell, the sound of the
bell. Bell sound, you want the bell. Okay.
And Emily, what happens if, is there ever a point when you're sculpting and you're sort of halfway through the process, if you like, and you just say, this just isn't going to work. The vision I had is not going to work. I've just got to abandon this.
Well, hardly ever, to be honest, because I'm trying to find out what the stone wants to do. So if the stone and I are not gelling for some reason, I mean, it's up to me to find a way to find what the stone wants to do.
It's a collaboration, isn't it?
It is absolutely a collaboration, yeah.
The idea of collaborating with the material, I think, is a sort of shared territory in a way, because when you're painting, you have to let the paint speak and also force the paint to do things you want it to do. And one of the interesting things about painting landscape and painting gardens is that gardens, by definition, are bits of the landscape that have had some structure imposed on them. And the artistic process is also about imposing structure on materials, but at the same time allowing the materials to speak. And so I suppose I'm collaborating with the gardens. I walk around the garden and really I'm trying to wait for the garden to speak. I want the garden to speak first, and then I'll kind of join the conversation. And sometimes you go to places and they don't speak to you. And sometimes you see pieces of stone and they don't speak to you either.
I call it wearing the dirty old overcoat, you know, and they're definitely hiding. And then you go in a little bit and you see what's inside. And in fact, they've been hiding their jewels. You know, there is something very similar, I think. I mean, paint, if you think of it as bits of the earth ground up and, you know, very, very carefully into particular forms. I mean, I work with a stone lapis lazuli from Afghanistan.
And that's the blue that the Madonna was painted in because it was the most valuable colour, the most expensive colour. And it was replaced, wasn't it, by ultramarine, and ultramarine's called ultramarine because it was beyond the ocean.
Yes. And it's a charity thing with a local charity so that we make sure that we're not just taking stuff away and not putting anything back.
Emily, just you mentioned that your grandmother was a sculptor, but you do come from a very artistic family and grew up indeed in Jay and Barry's old house on Bayswater Road. Just tell us a little bit about your family, because you are a family of extraordinary artists and politicians and writers and thinkers. I mean, your sister Louisa is a celebrated novelist.
As far as I know, there's only me and my grandmother that are the artists. But she was married to Scott of the Antarctic.
What about Peter Scott? Is he not a...
That's true. Yes, absolutely. I forgot Uncle Pete.
You forget.
But he was, he was actually, he used to go hunting. It was in the hunt and shoot and fishing area of Gloucestershire that he lived in. He used to go hunting. But he realised one morning when he was sitting in a wet puddle somewhere, icy, 4 o'clock in the morning, and he had his gun, And he said, the reason I'm here is not to shoot the ducks, but to admire the ducks. And he put his gun away and he became a conservationist and helped to found the World Wildlife Fund. So I always like those stories when hunters become conservation. It happens a lot.
Well, we're very, very keen to see your show, and it's on for a very short run. So everybody's got to run and scamper and get to it. So just tell us the dates, Emily.
Well, it opens on the 24th of October, mm-hmm. and it runs for 3 weeks.
And Francis, when does you open at Rousham, and then when does it move to John Martin for the bulk of the show?
Yeah, it's called, I don't know, I can't remember whether you said, but it's called 30 Gardens, mm-hmm. because, you know, for obvious reasons. It's at Rousham from the 5th to the 8th of October, and then it's at the John Martin Gallery in Albemarle Street from the 12th to the 27th of October. So there's a little bit of an overlap with Emily, so some people could go and see both.
Yeah. Fantastic. And they're so nearby to each other.
Around the corner from each other. Yeah, but a minute's walk.
Exactly. Well, huge good luck with these fabulous exhibitions, both of you. And thank you so much for being on the podcast.
The thing that you were advertising at the beginning, I want one.
Oh, well, you can get one if you can get one with a discount.
And obviously the sponsorship by Lomi of our podcast works a treat, because our guest, Emily Young, now wants to buy a Lomi. What was it that persuaded you, Emily, that you thought you needed a Lomi?
Well, I live in the middle of the countryside, and if you throw out your... you have a compost place, which we do, but lots of wild animals come, and it gets a bit chaotic. And this sounds like it's easier.
Once again, many thanks to Lomi for supporting us, and please don't fail to take advantage of this wonderful offer. You get 50 quid off a Lomi of your very own. You go to Lomi's website at uk.lomi.com and use the promo code BREAKOUT at the checkout.
Next week, I'm going up to Sheffield to see a brand new version of Molière's play, The Hypochondriac, which is opening at the Crucible. It's been adapted by the ever-popular Mersey poet Roger McGough, presenter of Poetry Please on Radio 4, who was also part of The Scaffold. Older listeners like me will remember their big hit, Lily the Pink. So I'm very excited to be talking to Roger McGough, and we're also going to be talking to writer and broadcaster Jonathan Maitland about his new play, The Interview, opening at the Park Theatre in London at the end of this month. And that's all about that interview with Martin Bashir that he did with Princess Diana. So next week's definitely going to be a fabulous listen.